Hello and welcome to the South Carolina Lead. You trust the lead to keep you up to date on important state news, and we've been doing that more often as our state faces the COVID-19 virus. I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode was recorded on October 5th, 2020, from my home studio here in Columbia. Just so you know, some of the information in this podcast may have changed by the time you've heard it. This podcast cuts through the noise and gives you South Carolina-specific COVID-19 news and stories. This episode features a conversation with an election security expert on the threats facing the 2020 polls, insight from a USC professor on electoral college scenarios and Senate races. We get a deeper understanding of economic factors influencing the economy and an update on the White House outbreak. Additionally, we want to hear your stories, so we set up a voicemail box to hear from y'all about your daily life in these uncertain times. Leave us a 1 minute long voicemail at 803-563-7169. Leave us your name, where you're calling from, and a little bit of information about what's going on in your world. Are you applying for uninsurance? Have you voted yet? Are you registered to vote? Have you got your absentee ballot? We want to know what's going on with you. Let us know, 803-563-7169. Now for the latest in South Carolina. Currently, the spread of COVID-19 is ongoing, widespread, and not contained, according to Department of Health and Environmental Control data. There have been 3,258 deaths, and currently there are 147,116 cases being reported in all 46 counties as of October 5th at 4 p.m. Our current percent positive rate is 11%, and our current recovery rate is 93%. So that's encouraging, but there are currently 599 patients hospitalized with COVID-19. 150 are in intensive care, and 72 are on ventilators. Okay, so in-person voting is underway. Lines are already stretching for blocks, and you should soon be receiving your mail-in ballot if you requested one. Now again, the witness signature has been thrown out, so here we are, on the march to November 3rd. But what about election security? What are the threats? What could the day after Election Day look like? Is voter fraud a major concern? I asked David Levine, an Elections Integrity Fellow at the Alliance for Securing Democracy, about all these questions and more on This Week in South Carolina.
You know, I think let's first touch on the disinformation piece. You know, what we have seen in our law enforcement and intelligence communities have borne this out is that a slew of foreign adversaries, including Russia, right, China, and Iran, have been disseminating disinformation in an effort, right, to sow discord, cause confusion and chaos, and lessen voter confidence, mm-hmm. right, in our 2020 election. On the flip side, we've seen Russia principally, right, attempting to try and both spread disinformation about their efforts to breach our election infrastructure, as well as potentially trying to breach different parts of our election infrastructure. And so, you know, obviously in 2016, we know through the Mueller report and the Senate Intelligence Committee's reports, we know that Russia tried to breach our election infrastructure. For example, they tried to modify and alter voter registration system data in at least one state. And it's something that I, as well as many others, are following to try and help ensure that that issue doesn't arise again here in 2020.
And David, when we look at 2016 to now 2020, should we feel more confident in at least the safeguards that have been put into place, maybe things behind the scenes that the average American doesn't really know what's going on when it comes to everything that, you know, the intelligence community does and election officials do? Should we feel more confident that there has been an improvement at least that since 2016?
The short answer is yes. Every voter that goes to vote, right, should feel confident that their vote will be cast and counted. And I think that's a really important message, right, for all voters, including, right, those that have already requested ballots and those that still haven't yet made a plan to vote for November. In terms of the steps that have been taken, There are a number that have been done that I think should be give people greater assurances about 2020. Number one, we've seen the federal government play a much more active role in helping secure the election infrastructure. Led by the Department of Homeland Security, we've seen the federal government play a much more supportive role towards state and local election officials. There's now more vulnerability scanning being done of a number of different pieces of election infrastructure to both prevent attacks, identify any potential issues, and work with state and local election officials so that if there are certain kinds of attacks that are made and they happen to be successful, state and local election officials are able to recover. On the other hand, we've also seen state and local election officials take steps to secure their systems. And one of the biggest things that they've done is introduced what I call sort of analog processes so that if their election infrastructure goes down or experiences issues, we still have backups in place. And to give you an example, right, we see an increased number in state and localities using paper-based voting systems, including, right, the state of South Carolina.
David, switching from maybe hacks and cybersecurity threats, I want to ask you about voter fraud. FBI Director Christopher Wray recently told lawmakers that the FBI had, quote, not seen historically any kind of coordinated national voter fraud effort in a major election, whether it's by mail or otherwise. So is it safe to assume that that will be the case for this year, too, and that maybe these concerns, people, you know, even the president talking about, you know, voting by mail not being safe, even though he does it himself, are overblown and that we can have faith in this system?
Yeah, and it's a great question. You know, voter fraud is exceedingly rare. The FBI director is spot on. Anyone who makes the case that voter fraud is anything other than exceedingly rare is making a point that aligns with disinformation rhetoric that's emanating from our foreign adversaries. And that kind of rhetoric has no place. And it frankly, you know, further sows chaos and confusion and create more discord ahead of the 2020 election process. Mm-hmm. Mail-in voting is a secure process. It's been a secure process, right, since it came about during the Civil War. It's a secure process now, as the Department of Homeland Security recently reaffirmed in a report it put out. And it's a process that if voters choose to exercise, they can feel confident that their vote will be cast and counted properly. Mail-in voting is a secure voting process. It's a unanimous opinion expressed by election experts. Right? The peaceful transition from one president to the next is at the heart of our democracy and shouldn't be in question. And the final results need to be accepted, because anything other than that, right, strikes at the heart of what we are about here as a democracy. Mm-hmm.
Moving on, let's take a national perspective on the presidential race. Last week, University of South Carolina political science professor Bob Oldendick gave a presentation during the USC Economic Outlook Forum in which he broke down potential electoral college scenarios that could happen on November 3rd. Here's one of them.
There are 18 states plus the District of Columbia that are reliably Democratic votes and provide Joe Biden with 219 electoral votes as his base. There are 20 states that are reliably Republican, provide Donald Trump with 126 electoral votes. And then there are these 12 potential toss-up or battleground states. And these are the battleground states, all the way from Michigan to Iowa. These are the 12 states. And those numbers there are the number of electoral votes. Based on what we know or what we think is going on with the polling and what's likely to happen in these states, kind of allocate these states to either to Biden or to Trump in the Electoral College. We'll start out with the ones I'm most confident in. The two states that I think are definitely going to go to Biden, Michigan and New Hampshire. While on the Trump side, the states of Florida, Arizona, Georgia, Ohio, Texas, and Iowa are probably in that direction. So if we allocate those in that way, this first pass then takes the Electoral College to 244 for Trump and 239 for Biden, leaving us with Minnesota, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Wisconsin. Of these four states, I believe that Pennsylvania and Minnesota will be captured by Biden, and that Wisconsin will go to Donald Trump. And if that's the case, that would take Joe Biden to 269 electoral votes, Donald Trump with 254, which leaves us with North Carolina. And North Carolina is really, of all these states, everybody believes the closest state. All the polls show about a 1 percentage point advantage to one candidate or the other, or it's tied. But in the end, I think much like what happened in 2016, North Carolina will go to Donald Trump, which would result in a 269-269 tie in the Electoral College, in which case the election would be decided by the House of Representatives in January.
If that scenario comes to pass, it would require state delegations in the House of Representatives to determine the election when they gavel in the 117th Congress in January. Currently, there are 26 Republican delegations, including South Carolina, but that could change after the election. Oldendick also gave an overview of U.S. Senate races. In order for Democrats to take the Senate, they would need a net 4 seats, or 3 plus the White House. This puts a spotlight on the 5 closest races to watch, he said, which are Arizona, Colorado, Maine, Montana, and North Carolina. Now, there are 13 potentially competitive Republican races, including South Carolina, and 2 potentially competitive Democratic ones. For South Carolina, Oldendick says there are 2 pieces of evidence that go in opposite directions, which make the race hard to call.
One is electoral history. If you look at the Senator Graham's previous races, in 2002, when he was first elected to the Senate, going against Alex Sanders, he won with 55% of the vote. And then his 2 re-election bids, he won with roughly 58% in each of those elections. And we have this electoral history in South Carolina. I like to refer to it often as a 55-45 state for the Republicans, because if you go back to 2018 and you look at the major statewide races, whether for governor or attorney general, the secretary of state race, all those races were pretty close to 55-45 races, in one case getting up to close to 57-58%. So that in terms of statewide races, Republicans have a natural advantage. So what makes this race so close? And that's the other piece of evidence we need to look at, and that is the fundraising totals. Because in the previous races, Senator Graham was able to far outspend his opponents. In 2002, it was about a 2-to-1 advantage that he had, well outspending his opponents in 2008 and 2014. But that's not the case in 2020. The latest figures from the Federal Election Commission show that both of these races, or both of these campaigns, have been able to raise about $30 million. And we know that in August, Jamie Harrison had a very good fundraising month, was able to raise about $10 million in August alone. And so in terms of the fundraising battle and the ability to compete, Jamie Harrison is in much better position than any of the previous 3 races. So what's going to be the deciding factor, or what do I look at and say, well, why would we put this in one column or the other? And for me, it's the presidential race. We believe that in this state, Donald Trump will probably take the presidential vote by 8 to 10 percentage points, which means that 4 or 5% of the people would have to split their vote and vote for Donald Trump for president and then vote for Jamie Harrison for Senate, or even a larger percentage if it's voting for Trump and then not voting in the Senate. And in looking at the data, it's very difficult for me to find where those voters come from, that there are some of them perhaps that are upset with Lindsey Graham for one reason or another and are not going to vote for him. But in order for them to vote for Donald Trump and then to switch their votes in the Senate race, I just haven't been able to find that group, which would lead me to put that check mark in the box for Jamie Harrison. So if we're going to make the outlook as of today, I would say that Senator Graham will be victorious in a very, very close vote.
That's some sage advice there from USC professor Bob Oldendick for you to file away as we get closer to Election Day. And of course, we didn't forget about the first Senate debate between Graham and Harrison. We're saving that recap for you in this week's Trail Bite. Also, mark your calendars for the next Senate debate, which is Friday evening at 7 p.m. from Spartanburg. You can watch that on Nexstar TV stations across the state. And the second South Carolina 1st Congressional District debate is Tuesday at 7 p.m. You can watch that debate on abcnews4.com and their social media platforms. We'll be right back. We're going to keep with the USC economic outlook again for our business section and focus on the differences playing out between Wall Street and Main Street. We've talked about this concept briefly before, but USC economics professor Doug Woodward has some greater insight on this topic because he is also the director of the Division of Research at the Darla Moore School of Business. But first, he tells us just how important Washington is in driving the economy at this point.
Well, what we've got is Washington to the rescue. That's why I brought Bob in here, because what happens in Washington really is going to determine the trajectory of the economy. We have had, since March and April, unprecedented stimulus coming out of Washington, coming from the federal government. This is highly unusual in scale and in scope. We have never, ever seen anything like this before. And what's also very unusual about this is that it was bipartisan. Remember back in March and April, we had overwhelming support. I think there's only one vote against the stimulus package. I don't think that's going to happen again, especially if we get into this contested election and maybe even after the election, if there's not a clear outcome. So we're in a much more difficult position going forward to rely on Washington to rescue the economy as it did with this unprecedented stimulus going back to April and March.
Woodward describes the FOMO mentality of investors on Wall Street versus the reality and risks still facing Main Street.
So let's do a reality check real quickly. We've got a real economy struggling. We got Main Street struggling. Right now, since August, we've got new jobless claims higher still than at the peak of the Great Recession. So we still got a lot of people out of work. Business failure still at an unprecedented level, still very high, more at risk of failure if the economy doesn't fully start functioning again. Because, as we all know, the pandemic is persisting. It's not over. This crisis isn't over, although it does seem to be over in China. They're opening up again and they're growing again. They're the only major economy where that's really happening. So the rest of the world is still facing the pandemic, and that's affecting the economy as we struggle to open up again. So we've got this real economy still in trouble, and yet the financial markets are exuberant. I don't know how the markets are doing today, the stock market's doing. Yesterday had a great day. But what we're seeing is assets, as opposed to production of goods and services. That's what we measure in GDP. But assets, which is a stock, like the stock market, are appreciating in a time of crisis. Never seen that before. In fact, wealthy Americans are in great shape. Sometimes Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk can make $4 to $5 billion in one day in wealth appreciation as a result of their ownership of stock. In fact, wealth is higher than it's ever been before in the United States. So income and jobs are hurting, but wealth is booming. And this is what a lot of people are questioning. Why is this the case? Well, one of the ways in which we've seen this wealth effect is in the housing market. We've seen a lot of people demanding houses. They want to put their money into wealth. And that's in the major form of accumulating wealth in the United States is in a house. That's driven by this incredible structural shift to remote work and education. This home buying really started in May. It really started picking up a lot. You know, the spring home buying season wasn't possible because of social distancing. And then we started opening up and we started to see a huge growth in the demand for single family housing because people are shifting to remote work and they're putting their money into houses, which is a form of wealth. 1 million new housing sales in August, the highest since 2006, the peak of the housing boom at that time.
But what about the financial markets? Well, they're off the charts right now.
What we often hear, and this is something I hear from the public a lot, you know, but of course the stock market is not the economy. Well, yes and no. It in some sense does reflect the economy. It reflects the future economy and the future ability of corporations to generate new earnings. And that depends on the real economy returning, but it's sort of anticipating the future. But really, why is this happening? We're back up to the level of stocks. They've appreciated to the same level that they were before the crisis. And that happened very, very quickly. We're almost in a euphoric period.
The Oracle of Omaha himself, Mr. Warren Buffett, says that markets are overvalued right now, meaning it's more hype than fundamentals. So trade with caution, dear leader. And again, give us some stock tips, y'all. Give us the tips. Now, a short medical section for you. President Donald Trump was hospitalized at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Maryland hours after we wrapped our podcast on Friday. The president was sick enough from COVID-19 to receive oxygen and several therapeutics, including experimental medications and steroids. He is not taking hydroxychloroquine despite being a vocal advocate for the anti-malaria drug as a COVID-19 treatment early on. Details about the timing and more are still trickling out from a White House now at the center of its own outbreak, with 27 people in and around the White House afflicted by the virus. And we're all paying close attention to this, of course, and we're also maybe regretting the title of last Friday's episode. We should have called it Outbreak at 1600 Pennsylvania. It's okay. Now, this is our wind down section where we want to hear from you. Tell us what's going on in your world. Do you still have to go to work? Are you a student in college that is open? What's it like? How's everyone doing so far? We're a couple weeks into the school year. How's everyone handling it? Parents, I'm talking to you too. You know, have you been going out to eat? What's everyone's thoughts? It's getting colder out there. Spooky season. You going to get the pumpkins and apples? People not carving pumpkins. That's what we can talk about. Oh, God. We'll talk about that in a minute. Anyway, let us know. 803-563-7169. We love hearing from y'all. Leave us your name, where you're calling from, and a message no longer than 3 minutes. 803-563-7169. AT, do we have messages on this Monday?
We still have messages. These aren't backed up from before our earned break that we earned. this is from Wednesday. It's last Wednesday, I guess. It's
cool.
Catherine, again, repeat caller. Love them. Awesome. We love you guys. Let's roll it.
All right.
Hey, Gavin and AT. This is Catherine calling from Aiken, South Carolina with an update. I'm coming up on the end of my 12-week maternity leave and I'm getting ready to go back to work at the hospital where I'm a nurse. I know things are going to be very different than they were when I went out to have my baby. As you know, things are constantly changing and we live in uncertain times, but that's just our new reality. Even though sometimes it feels like society, as I've always known it, is just unraveling, I am grateful for all of the good things that have happened this year. My husband and I are still employed. We have had a lot of help from family and friends with our kids. Our older two kids have been back in preschool for a few weeks, and that's been going well. They're very happy to be back, and I'm very happy that they're back. And most importantly, our new baby girl is happy and healthy and doing very well, and she'll be going to daycare at the same location as her siblings. So just wanted to tell you thanks for helping us all to stay informed. Keep up the good work, and I'll be thinking of you guys when I'm back on the job. Stay well. Have a great day.
Catherine from Aiken, great to hear from you. Glad all is well with you and the family, and we're looking forward to hearing from you when you go back to work, too. Would love to hear how things are going, especially how different things are when you get there. So thanks for calling.
Were you absolutely shell-shocked when you go back? Please let us know. Or was having, three small children and a brand new baby? Are you good enough dealing with the insanity of that to deal with the insanity of COVID at work?
It might be a break.
Who knows?
some quiet time sometimes, perhaps. So, yeah, we know that's not easy work, but God bless you there. AT, your Eagles won. I'm glad. Everyone's happy.
Yes, Eagles won finally. It was excruciating. The organs inside my body hurt while I watched. Everything was bad. I also had I had a loss in the Shire household.
Oh my God! What happened?
Yeah, it's really sad. I feel really sad. The pot that I used to boil pasta water, it broke.
Oh my God! Another tragedy afflicting you.
I've had years with this pot. Mm. I mean, it's a garbage pot. It cost maybe $12, you know.
Garbage pot.
But either Caitlin or I wedged it into a drawer just to make it fit, and it's oblong and it doesn't work anymore.
Oh God! It's such a tragedy. You know, between your. The mental health of your sports teams to now this inanimate object being broken.
It's a dark day in my household, and we'll probably have a Viking funeral. I don't know.
Yeah.
But Gavin,
sounds about right.
I heard you have you're in the spooky spirit.
I'm
and you have a movie
season.
Review.
Yeah.
You have a movie review.
If you're looking for a spooky movie, check out The Possession.
Yes,
it's on Netflix.
Yeah.
Worth it. It's like your it's your typical family possession drama, you know? Oh, why is the daughter being so kooky? Well, she's possessed by a Jewish demon, okay?
Oh.
Spoiler alert. Don't buy wooden boxes from yard sales, okay? Because they might be possessed. They might be harnessing a demon in there that you may unwillingly open and, you know, invite out to dance in the world. But
you don't buy boxes to not open them. You know what I mean? You're going to open the box.
You're going to open the box, especially if there's a bunch of Hebrew writing on it that you're like, oh, okay, very interested. What's happening here? And it also had like a lot of Conjuring vibes to it too. So if you enjoy
The
Conjuring.
Which is a great two movies, except the British one is a little funny when they're like, show yourself, you demon.
Well, then I've seen some of the Annabelle ones. And the Nun.
Annabelle's don't hold up.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely The Conjuring. That's where it's at for sure.
Conjuring 2 is good.
I'm looking this up on the internet right now, which I'm online. And it looks like another one is coming out in 2021. The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. So we got that to look forward to in 2021, folks. But yeah, so I checked that out. And then so I went from this really quality horror movie, I would say. Very fun. I mean, you can watch with the whole family, if you ask me. not responsible for nightmares.
SCETV does not.
SCETV does not come out indoors. Yeah. And then so I went from this, The Possession, which is great, to I was like, okay, what else is out there? Well, give me some trash. So I watched The Wishmaster, copyright 1997. Yeah. And it is everything you want it to be, from the sounds to the effects to the plot. I mean, trying to outguess a genie, like a devil genie, about how you're going to put him back in the ruby that you discovered him in. I mean, it had everything, folks. And there's two more spinoffs. And I was like, it was 11:30 at night. I'm usually in bed, but I was like, oh, can I find these anywhere?
You were about to stay up all night. You're ready to stay up all night.
Thank God the streaming services restricted me because they weren't streaming anywhere. I was tempted to rent it, but I'm not there yet. Maybe tonight.
You couldn't trust yourself. They had to stop you. Yeah.
And I tell you, this came off of a weekend when I was just, like I said, I was down in James Island with my parents, and we were just watching wall-to-wall news. Like, we were doing some things. We went walking down the peninsula. We went to Tommy Condon's for a beer. I know you hate Tommy Condon's.
I don't like Irish pubs.
I mean, it's a trash Irish bar. Don't get me wrong, but we're like, let's go get some pints. We could sit outside. It was safe. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't do any physical exercise without rewarding ourselves. So
no,
we
did that
and then watched the debate. And we just watched a lot of news, obviously, with the president's situation going on. So
it was a big news weekend.
It was. And those two are always just like mainlining TV. So I kind of joined in. By the end of it, I felt like I could just recite everything that was happening. So,
did you feel drunk on cable while
you were
there?
I was so drunk on
cable. Because I know you don't have cable.
Oh my God. And so many of the political commercials, you know, it's back to back. You know, one ad telling you one thing about somebody, the next ad completely being like, are you sure about him? Like, I don't know. Like,
I know. Last time you had access to cable, you fell in love with Below Deck Mediterranean.
Yeah, we did.
Which is on tonight. My wife I would be remiss if I didn't mention it.
No, I'm watching the reality TV show called America 2020. I can't get enough. And it's all over the place.
It hurts.
It's
it
all
hurts
over
me.
The place.
Yeah. Right,
I mean, the
let's
twists
say goodbye.
Turns.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye, everyone.
This is it for me. My pot's gone. I can't handle it.
We still got it going. At least, you know, at least the Eagles didn't lose, so you didn't get a hit with a double whammy. But faith. We have faith. Thanks again for listening to the pod, guys. Show us your appreciation by leaving us a review on iTunes or a voicemail at 803-563-7169. You can stay up to date with the latest news on scetv.org and southcarolinapublicradio.org. And don't forget to support your local newspapers. Also, consider becoming an ETV member. Membership starts at just $40, and if you pledge at the $75 level, you get access to PBS Passport and all the great programming your donation helps support. Though I will say, I don't think there's any scary movies on PBS Passport. Might need to change that.
They got debates.
it's just the debates. For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina. Dude, you know I'm not even trying, okay? If I really want to try, it would be awesome.
If I wanted to try, do so well.